Today's presenter is Justin Freed. Justin has been a member of the IBM Western MQ Level 2 service team since 1997. This time, he has configured and diagnosed every product from MQ Series version 1 to the latest Webshare MQ 7.0 release. Since 2004, Justin has also been responsible for servicing the service integration bus integrated in Webshare application server. At this time, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Justin.
Good morning, everybody. This is Justin Freese. I'd like to thank you for joining this webcast, and I hope it will be very helpful to everybody on the call. Elijah, if we could go to slide 2, I'm going to talk about what we're going to talk about. This morning, we're going to talk a bit about the network that MQ runs on, and other applications apart from MQ, too, but this is focusing on MQ specifically. We're going to talk about several layers in the network that exist underneath Webshare MQ, focusing particularly on the Internet Protocol Layer, or IP, and the Transmission Control Protocol Layer, or TCP. We're going to talk about how Webshare MQ channels use these network layers to transfer your messages. And finally, we're going to talk about the TCP Keep Alive option, which, based on the problem records we receive in MQ Level 2, is always a popular topic of conversation. Getting it right can be very important to making sure your network and that Webshare MQ runs well. And finally, we'll take questions, and I will try to give you the best answers I can. Let's go on to slide 3. Okay, slide 3 has a view of the layers that you may find in your network. If any of you have dealt with something called the OSI model, this looks pretty similar to that. The OSI model defined several layers in the network. It's been around for quite a long time. I've tried to simplify it a little bit here, though. At the top layer, in sort of a purple color, we have your business applications, which are trying to send business data from one machine to another. And that data could be anything. They could be bank transactions. They could be web services requests. You know better than I the kind of data that you're trying to send over MQ. One layer below your applications is Webshare MQ itself. Its job is to transfer messages from system to system, reliably and without any loss at all. Now, Webshare MQ relies immediately beneath it on what's called the TCP layer. TCP is responsible for transmitting segments across a network and acknowledging those segments and making sure that the data reliably traverses the network. And TCP itself sits on top of what's called the IP layer. This is down to the level where we're talking about packets being routed from routers and across switches and other networking hardware from machine to machine. And the IP layer itself sits on top, usually, of Ethernet. There are other types of protocols here, but I'm just going to generalize and assume most people are running Ethernet networks. And Ethernet networks are responsible for routing what are called frames from one network card to another. And finally, the very lowest layer of all is the hardware layer, where you have cables and things like that that are responsible for transmitting bits of data, electrical signals across. So that's a general top-down view of your network. And when you run into a problem, it's an interesting problem at times to figure out where, at which layer, is something going wrong. So take a look at that. We're going to now work bottom-up, starting on slide 4. And about these very low layers, hardware and Ethernet, I'm not going to say very much. In truth, this is a bit low level for most administrators to get into. At the hardware layer, for example, my experience pretty much comes down to making sure the cord is plugged into the back of the machine well, or maybe swapping out a cable. But the hardware layer, this is, again, just the hardware that transmits your data from place to place, cables, hubs, connectors. The hardware layer deals with things like voltages. This is a bit low level for us, so I'm going to skip on to the Ethernet level. The Ethernet level, in the OSI model I mentioned earlier, this would be called the data link layer. With Ethernet, data is transmitted as what are called frames of a certain limited size. Ethernet devices have what is called a maximum transmission unit, or MTU, and that is going to be significant later on for the higher levels of networking. Now, most Ethernet networks, the maximum size of a frame is going to be 1,500 bytes. NIC is a term you may hear, often pronounced NIC. It means a network interface card, such as an Ethernet card, are responsible for moving these frames around. And each NIC has a hardware address, typically called a MAC address or Media Access Control address. So the Ethernet level is responsible for moving frames back and forth between hardware devices based on their MAC address. For the most part, we MQ administrators don't need to look at this too often. It's very rare, I found, that I've ever had to get down into this level of the network. And these frames that we're talking about are going to contain data from the upper levels of the network, which we're going to focus on now. Slide 5. Slide 5 is the introduction to the Internet Protocol Layer, or IP. This, in the OSI model, would be called the network layer. And at the network layer, the bits of data that are flying around your network are called packets. And IP is interesting in that there are two versions of the Internet Protocol, IP version 4 and IP version 6, which is rapidly becoming more and more important, and we'll discuss why that is. Now, Internet Protocol packets are affected by the layer beneath them. You'll see that their size is limited by the maximum transmission unit size of the network. So if your Ethernet cards can only send 1,500 byte packets, you are going to get performance problems or other issues if you try to send much larger sizes. IP packets, if they are too large, they can be fragmented, split into smaller chunks in order to make it across the network. But it's important to know that the Internet Protocol by itself is not reliable. IP can drop packets in the network, or they can be routed incorrectly and float around the network for a while. They can arrive out of order if you're sending data between two different machines. The data in these packets, the packets themselves, are routed between machines based on IP addresses, and the payload in each IP packet is, again, going to be information from the next layer up in the network. So let's go on to slide 6, and we'll take a look at an IP packet. Okay, now first of all, Internet Protocol version 4 is what we'll speak to first. I've mentioned here that the IPv4 is defined by RFC 791 from 1981, and these RFC numbers bear a little explanation. There is a group called the Internet Engineering Task Force, or IETF, which has developed a lot of these protocols, like IP and TCP, and the documents that describe how they work are called RFCs, or requests for comment. And there are hundreds of RFCs on many different topics. Some of them have been adopted and are used today, others not so. Some of them are even April Fool's jokes, if you can believe that. So the RFC numbers, if you are interested in reading more, I will list them as we go along, and you can do a search on your internet browser if you want to read the actual data. So now, an IPv4 packet we see to the right. Two of the most important fields are the fourth and fifth line down in that packet, the source address and the destination address. And these are particularly important. They're essential for routing data, routing these packets over a network. You need to know where you're coming from and where you're going to. IPv4 addresses are 32 bits long, and we're used to seeing them in this dotted notation, like 192.168.1.100 is a pretty common address. There's a special address called the loopback address, typically known as 127.0.0.1. Anything you send to that address will actually just stay within the machine and come right back at you, and actually never goes out over the wire, so to speak. There is a problem with IP version 4. I'm sure many of you know that the world has been running out of IPv4 addresses. Theoretically, there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 billion of them, but we're still running out, and the next FOIL, which we're not going to go to just yet, will explain what the solution is to that problem. Now, IPv4 packets, the maximum theoretical size is 64 kilobytes. However, due to the underlying network, typically they're going to be much smaller than that. And the header size, the header by which I mean that data structure to the right, is a variable length. Typically it's just 20 bytes, but it could be longer if somebody is using extra TCP options. Some other fields to note in that packet header. On the third line down on the left, there is a field called time to live, or often abbreviated TTL. That field is usually initialized to a value of 255. And as a packet is being routed from machine to machine or router to router across the network, every time a second elapses, that number should count down. And this is intended to make sure that packets can't live forever and ever and ever, that eventually, if they're in a loop or something, they will expire and go away. In practice, usually every router will just decrement that number by one as it forwards the packet along. They usually don't actually work off of counting seconds. Another thing to note here is the flags field, which is in the second row on the right-hand side. One of the flags that's particularly important is a flag called don't fragment. I mentioned that that most networks have a maximum transmission unit of, say, 1,500 bytes. But it's always possible, if you're sending IP packets through a network, that there might be some router in between that can't actually handle packets that large. So what happens if you send a 1,500-byte packet and somebody can't handle it? Well, they'll take the packet and they will fragment it into two smaller packets that they can send on. However, that's a kind of a performance hit to do such a thing. If you're trying to get data through very fast, you don't want fragmentation happening inside your network. So if you set, or if the operating system, I should say, sets the don't fragment bit in a packet, if it gets to a point where it can't go any further because it would be too large, an error is going to be sent back to your originating machine. And on the left-hand side, that error is going to be called an Internet Control Message Protocol packet, or ICMP. ICMP is also an RFC 792 from 1981, and ICMP packets are used to indicate error conditions, or sometimes they are used to convey some status information. So again, to avoid fragmentation, operating systems will sometimes set the don't fragment bit, send large packets out, and if they get an error back saying fragmentation is needed, then they'll retry using a smaller MTU size. And the goal is to make sure the packets can get to the final destination in one piece. Okay, let's go on to, before we go on to the next FOIL, focus your eyes, if you would, on that packet header to the right. There are a lot of little fields in there, and I haven't talked about some of them, because frankly, a lot of them aren't really used very much, or certainly not for their intended purpose. IPv4 has been around for 27 years, and some of the plans for it didn't necessarily pan out the way people expected. So the actual purpose of some of those fields is a bit nebulous at times, and there have been some efforts to use them for other reasons. Now, if you look at that packet header, it's a bit fragmented, lots of little bits. It almost looks like the beginning of a Mondrian painting or something like that. Let's go to the next FOIL and see how IPv6 changes that. FOIL number 7. And as you can see, things are much simpler in that packet now, the packet header. And two things are a little bit larger, and that would be the source address and the destination address. To combat the problem with the Internet running out of IPv4 addresses, IPv6 makes each address 128 bits instead of 32 bits long, which means that there are trillions and trillions and trillions of addresses, and with luck and a following breeze, we will never run out of them again. IPv6 addresses are written a little bit differently. I've given an example there, 2001 colon, et cetera, et cetera. That's an example of a fully written out IPv6 address. Because they're so long, it is possible to write them in a shortened form. If you have a whole bunch of zeros, like that address does in the middle, you can notate that with a double colon. And then the system will know, just fill in as many zeros there as are needed. And you may notice that in each little group of numbers, leading zeros can also be dropped if you wish. The loopback address in IPv6 is just colon, colon, 1. If you were to spell it out, it would be all zeros with the number 1 at the very end. The maximum packet size for IPv6 is, again, 64 kilobytes. However, there are options to allow packets all the way up to 4 gigabytes, but I think we're not likely to have to worry about that at the moment. It's also interesting to see that the header, an IPv6 header, although it's larger, it is a fixed size, 40 bytes always. And finally, to go along with IPv6, we have a slightly newer version of that Internet Control Message Protocol, ICMPv6. It serves the same purpose as before, indicating when there's an error or conveying some status information. And one other change, in row 2 of the packet header, you will see a hop limit. That is the same thing as the time to live variable from IPv4. It's just that they recognize that we're really just counting down. Each hop across the network drops that number by 1, and if a packet reaches a value of 0, it gets thrown away. On to foil number 8, please. There are some tools that work at the IP layer. Ping is a program I think just about everybody has used at one point or another. Ping is a program that tests to see whether you have connectivity from one machine to another. And the way it works is by sending those ICMP packets. It sends what's called an echo request packet, and if it reaches its intended recipient, the operating system will send back an echo reply packet. So Ping actually relies on these ICMP error packets to see if things are working or not. There's another program called TraceRoute. TraceRoute 6 is an IP version 6 edition of it, and on Windows it's just called TraceRt. And this is a program that tries to map out how exactly are we getting from my machine to the target machine. How many hops are there along the way? And it does this a fairly clever way. It sends out packets with an artificially manipulated time to live or hop limit. So the first packet has a time-to-live limit of 1, and it makes it one hop over and then expires. And when it expires on that first hop, that machine or router or whatever it is will send back a time-exceeded response. And then it sends out another packet with a TTL or a hop limit of 2, and that will go 2 hops out and expire, and an error will come back. So using these artificially generated packets, we can figure out what's between us and the target machine. A similar version of that for Linux is called TracePath. But TracePath is useful in that it will not only map out the path to the target machine, but it will figure out what is the maximum transmission unit size all along the network. So you can see, it's 1,500 bytes, 1,500 bytes, 1,400 bytes. And you can see if perhaps there's a router on your network that needs to be reconfigured to accept a larger packet size. And on Windows, there's another program called PathPing, which I'll talk about a little bit more. That's really quite a useful program. One thing to say about these tools, on some networks, these tools may not work always as you expect. For security reasons, some networks will filter out some of these packets and disallow them. So if you find that ping or trace route doesn't work on your network, you might want to talk with your network people, and they may have a very good reason for that. Let's continue to slide 9, which is a PathPing example. This is just an example of the PathPing program. I think I've not seen people use this very much. It's unique to Windows as far as I know, but it's a great program that not only does a trace route, it shows you how many hops from your machine to the target, but it will send a bunch of packets over a period of time and try to tell you how reliable is each hop in the network. Are some of those hops losing packets, or are they sending all of the packets 100% reliably? And it will print out a report trying to map that out and show you where are you losing packets. So for those of you who are running WebCRMQ on Windows and suspect there may be a network problem, if your network will allow it, try using the PathPane program, and it may be a quick way to identify misbehaving network hardware. Let's go on to slide 10 now. Having talked about the IP layer, we're going to go up to the next layer in the network. One thing I forgot to say, by the way, the very first slide that had that sort of rainbow showing the different network layers, I've tried to keep the headers on each of these foils in line with whatever color they were on that first packet. So we've just moved from IP, which is green, up to transmission control protocol, which is blue. Now, the transmission control protocol is in the OSI model. You would see that called the session layer. And TCP sends data in what are called segments. However, each TCP segment fits inside an IP packet, and therefore they're often just referred to as TCP IP packets. That's pretty much what I say, and I think most people use that terminology. Now, a TCP segment or packet, if you prefer, has what's called a maximum segment size. And this size is limited by the packet size that IP can handle, which is limited by the Ethernet or other network packet MTU size. TCP does some things, though, that IP does not. If TCP detects that packets have been dropped, it will retransmit them. If packets arrive in the wrong order, TCP will rearrange them in the right order. And if TCP sees that duplicate packets are coming through the network, it will toss away the duplicate. And any nonsense packets, it will completely discard. And TCP packets contain, or segments, contain data from the upper layers, things like MQ. So let's go to foil 11, where we'll see the TCP packet header. In a TCP IP packet, this is going to follow immediately after the IP header. And here again, 1981, that was a busy year for people. That's when TCP was formally defined in RFC 793. TCP is a bit different than IP in that it is connection-oriented. We're talking here now about two programs that are linked together exchanging data. And TCP connections are full duplex. Data flows in both directions. A TCP header, which you see to the right, is 20 or more bytes. There may be options that make a TCP header larger than 20 bytes. Some of those options include the ability to add timestamps to these packets, ability to choose a maximum segment size. There's something called window scaling, selective acknowledgement. We'll talk a little bit about some of these options in a few foils. TCP adds reliability on top of the Internet Protocol. We said that Internet Protocol can just drop your packet and be quite happy doing so. TCP is going to take an unreliable Internet protocol and make it reliable. And in order to do that, TCP is very stateful, which I'll explain later, and kind of complex at times. Let's go on to the next foil. I want to say a quick word about a partner protocol to TCP, and that's called UDP, or the User Datagram Protocol. It sits more or less at the same layer in the network as TCP and has almost none of its features. UDP is not something you're going to run into very much, but it still is used today for things like looking up DNS names. If you give MQ a host name and it needs to figure out the IP address, there's going to be some UDP traffic in all likelihood occurring. If you look at the header off to the right, it's simplicity itself. A source port, a destination port, just about nothing else. So UDP is connectionless. If you write a program that uses UDP, it just sends a packet and flings it off into the void, and who knows if it gets there or not. Now, anybody who's writing programs that use UDP will have to work out some sort of scheme for acknowledging and retransmitting packets. Effectively, if you use UDP, you're going to end up mimicking a bit of what the operating system does for you with TCP. Now, UDP was briefly supported by MQ on AIX only. It was added in 5.1 and was removed by MQ version 6, so at this point it's really just a memory in most cases. It was used for client devices running on older Windows platforms, but alas, is no more. So UDP gives us nothing of the features of TCP, which we're going to speak to now in slide 13. Now, I apologize. It looks like we might have had a little translation error on that slide. I'll explain that in a moment. The next few slides are going to discuss the TCP header from FOIL 11, so if you wish to keep that in front of you, it may be useful to refer to it. Every TCP packet, every header, has a source and a destination port. And these port numbers are used to identify who are we talking to at the target machine. And so every TCP/IP connection has two endpoints, one on the sending machine, one on the receiving machine. These are typically programs like an MQ sender channel and an MQ receiver channel, for example. And each TCP/IP connection is going to be identified by four different characteristics. The client IP address, number one. Number two, the client port number. Number three, that should say the server IP address. And number four, the server port number. So by looking at a packet, you can look at these port numbers and addresses, and you can tell exactly what connection that packet is for. Now, port numbers are sometimes confusing for folks, but I have an analogy that may help. It's a little bit like making a phone call between two hotels. If you're staying in a hotel and your friend is staying in another hotel, in order to make a phone call, you might need to call from your hotel to the main phone number, the main switchboard of the other hotel. That would be like an IP address. And to reach your friend, you're going to need to know their room number. What room are they in? So you'll call the other hotel and say, please give me room 137. And that will connect you to your partner endpoint, so to speak. Some of the port numbers are restricted. So ports 1 through 1023, typically most programs need to be running as some form of super user, administrator, or on Unix systems as a root in order to use those. MQ typically does not use lower port numbers, although I suppose you could configure it to do so. Let's go on to slide 14. Slide 14, this is where we're going to start getting into how TCP does reliability. There is a field in the packet header called a sequence number. And the sequence number is negotiated when a TCP connection starts up. Each side chooses what's called an initial sequence number. And for security reasons, these are randomly chosen. So when a TCP connection begins, a client might choose 585.01.256, and the server may choose that larger number that's written there. And in an established TCP connection, as bytes of data are sent across the wire, these sequence numbers increase and increase and increase. So if we take our values from above, if the client started at 585.01.256 and it has sent 10 megabytes of data, its sequence number will be up to 6898.7107 bytes. So we've accounted for every last one of those. Similarly, the server, if it started at that much higher number above, after 100 megabytes, its sequence number will be 800390. You may be wondering, well, what happened there? Well, sequence numbers are only 32-bit numbers. They go up to a little bit over 4 billion, and then they wrap around. And wrap around is something that occurs every day in networks. If you're going flat out, these days you can wrap around a sequence number in just a few minutes. Let's go now on to slide 15, where we're going to talk about acknowledgement numbers. When one side sends a packet with a sequence number, it will be looking for an acknowledgement to come back from the other side, saying, yep, I've received that data. And so the acknowledgement number that comes back is going to give the next sequence number that the receiving machine expects. So, for example, if a server is going to send a packet with a sequence number of 800390, and the packet also includes 100 bytes of data, it's really sending bytes 800390 through 800399. But the acknowledgement coming back will be for 800490. That's the next byte that the other side is expecting. What happens now if a packet goes missing? So say the server sends sequence 490. I'm going to leave off the 800 now. Server sends 490 plus 100 bytes. Maybe that packet gets lost for some reason. So the server continues on, not knowing, and he sends packet 590 plus 100 bytes. And that gets through. And the client says, well, wait a minute, I wasn't expecting 800590, I was expecting 800490. So it sends back a packet with an acknowledgement to 800490. Well, maybe the server has already sent more data. It sent 800690 plus 100 bytes. And the client says, no, I'm expecting 800490. So you can see that the client has stalled on its acknowledgement number. It's not moving forward. So the server finally gets an acknowledgement and says, oh, I've got to resend some data. And it will send 800490 plus 300 bytes of data, because we've already had one packet go missing and two other packets that the client couldn't accept because they were out of order. And if the client receives that packet, it will finally acknowledge all the way up through 800790. Let's go on to FOIL 16. We're going to talk about an option in TCP called selective acknowledgement, which is intended to make the previous scenario a little bit better. Rather than just acknowledging what is the next byte of data we expect, the client side, or the either side, frankly, can can tell the other side, hey, I received some data, but I'll tell you where I'm missing holes in this data. And so it allows just those holes to be filled in again. So let's revisit the last scenario using selective acknowledgement. Server sends sequence number 800490 plus 100 bytes, and it goes missing. It sends 800590 and 100 bytes. Well, the client gets that, but it can only acknowledge up through 800490, but it selectively acknowledges 590 through 690, saying, all right, you need to get me 490, but I do have this extra data beyond that. And say the server again sends 800690 plus 100 bytes, and the client responds saying, I still need 490, but now I have 590 through 790. So then finally, the server responds by sending 800490 plus 100 bytes, not 300, just enough to fill in that hole. And finally now, the client can acknowledge all the way up through 800790. Now, with 100-byte packets, that may not sound like a lot, but once you start getting larger packets, selective acknowledgement can improve performance. But if you do see selective acknowledgement happening, it's a sign that there are packets going missing. That's not necessarily a very good thing in your network. Let's go on to the next FOIL, please. Window size. One thing that TCP does that the Internet Protocol does not is try to control how much data is being sent. Imagine if you have an IBM Z10 mainframe streaming data down to your PDA. I'm guessing I know which side is going to win if there isn't some form of control. The mainframe's just going to overload your PDA. So there's this thing called the window field, which says how much data can one end of the connection accept? How much data does it have room for? So if the receiver has a certain amount of space, say 64 kilobytes, as the sender sends some data, that window will shrink. Send 10K, and maybe we can only the window size will drop from 64K to 54K. Maybe it'll drop to 30K, 20K, 10K. The window can drop all the way to zero, which means that one side is completely full. It can't accept any more data. Now, the window closing like that may indicate a performance problem. It may not. Between any two machines, one is probably going to be faster than the other, so you may see the window drop to zero and it's not a problem. It really depends on the particular situation. There's also something called the window scaling option. For historical reasons, the maximum window size is a 16-bit value. It can only go up to 64 kilobytes. But there is, for fast networks, a scaling option that can say, well, we're going to really multiply that window size by values of 2, by 4, by 8, and so forth. So on some very fast networks, you may see something called window scaling going on. And on we go. FOIL 18, these are quite important, as we'll see, flags. Every TCP packet will have some flags set that control what's going on with the connection. So when a connection is being established, you will see a flag called SYN, or a SYN flag, which means we are synchronizing our sequence numbers. And every SYN flag counts as one byte of data in terms of acknowledging and those sequence numbers going back and forth. When a connection is closing down, you will see a FIN packet, which means that we're finished sending data. The most common flag you're going to see on just about every packet is the ACK flag for acknowledging data. In fact, I think there's only one packet that will never have an ACK flag, and everyone otherwise will acknowledge some data. And finally, there's a packet called, or a flag called RST, the reset flag. And that's not good. It means that a connection is being reset forcefully. Hopefully you're not going to see that too often because it will kill a TCP connection. There are other flags that you may see, but we're not going to discuss those here. I'll briefly mention the PSH flag, which means push. It's a flag that means TCP is supposed to push this data through as fast as it can. I'm going to mention it just because you will see it a lot in packets, but practically these days it doesn't necessarily mean that much anymore. So if you see the push flag, you can probably ignore it. So let's go on to see how these flags are used in FOIL 19. Establishing a TCP connection. This would be like an MQ sender channel trying to start up and requesting that the operating system get a connection to the remote machine. There is what's going to be called a three-way handshake, which means there are three packets that must occur for a connection to be established. First, the client side is going to send a packet with the SYN flag for synchronizing, and it's going to give an initial sequence number, plus any options that it may want. If everything works, the server will respond with a flag that has the SYN and ACK flags set, plus its own initial sequence number and options. And finally, the client will acknowledge that response from the server with just a plain old ACK. So down below we have an example. The client sends a SYN packet with an initial sequence number of 58501256, and maybe it's requesting two options like selective acknowledgments and timestamps. And the server responds with a SYN ACK. It's got its own sequence number there, plus it's acknowledging the client SYN flag. And it says, I just want to do timestamps, no SAC for me, please. And finally, the client responds with an acknowledgement. Now, at this point, three packets and we have an established connection. Let's go to slide 20 to see how a connection ends. To terminate a connection, typically there's going to be either three or four packets that go back and forth. What has to happen is that each end of the connection has to send a FIN packet and get back an ACK packet. So whether you have three or four packets to close the connection depends. Do both sides choose to shut down at the same time, or one side can close its end of the connection, and the other side can say, that's great, but I'm still going to keep sending you data. That's perfectly valid in TCP. So for example, let's take a look at down below, packet number one. One side says, all right, I'm done sending. I'm going to send you a FIN packet, the FIN flag. And I mentioned ACK because just about every packet will have an ACK of some kind. So that side sends a FIN, and along with the FIN, there are still 100 bytes of data, presumably the last bytes of data that it's sending. Packet number two, the other side says, great, I'll acknowledge your data, and I'm acknowledging your FIN as well. Thanks, and we're all done. And then I put in a dashed line to say, time may pass here. It's possible that the other side may want to continue sending data. It may have some still queued up. But eventually, it will send a FIN packet of its own, and then the first side will send an acknowledgement, and at that point, the connection is done. So these are four packets. How could this be three packets? Well, we could merge packets two and three. It could be that packet one is a FIN going over, and the other side might reply with a FIN and an ACK, saying, okay, I'm done too. And in which case, we only need three packets to close the connection. Now, let's go on to FOIL 21. After a connection ends, and I apologize, but we have a little corruption on this FOIL as well. After a connection ends in this clean, orderly fashion, that same exact connection can't be reestablished right away. There's a bit of a waiting period. And by that, I mean any packets that are for the same client IP address and client port number, and the same, that should read server IP address and server port number. those packets are going to be discarded. Because it's possible that there may be some misrouted packets floating around in the network for this connection, and the operating system wants to give them time to flow around the network and eventually expire and die. So immediately after a connection goes down, the same exact connection can't be reestablished for a little while. That period is called the time wait state. And the length of time that it waits is twice the MSL value. Well, what is MSL? That's a value called the maximum segment life. It was defined in 1981 as being 2 minutes. However, in modern systems, that value might actually be as low as 15 seconds. So I think AIX goes as low as 15 seconds. And some systems may be a minute or 30 seconds. So it varies from system to system. Go on to FOIL 22. There's another way of ending a connection, which is via the reset flag. This is a pretty ugly way for a connection to go down, but sometimes it happens. A reset flag immediately ends a TCP connection. It's gone. There's no time wait state. There's nothing. It's just gone. There is no acknowledgement needed for a reset flag at all. Resets usually indicate something abnormal has happened. Reasons why you might see a reset? Well, suppose you try to connect an MQ sender channel to a machine without a listener running. That's going to generate a reset packet right away. If you have a program that closes a connection while there's still data to be sent, you may, in some circumstances, get a reset packet there. Sometimes you won't. That's actually a little bit up to the application how it wants to close the connection. If a program crashes, the operating system will close its connection. And again, it might close cleanly or it might do a reset, depending on how the program was operating at the time. And finally, more and more these days, we see cases where connections get reset because some of the networking hardware in the middle of the connection maybe runs into trouble. If you have a router that's maybe runs out of memory, I've seen routers suddenly spray whole batches of reset packets, killing all the connections coming through them. That's not too pleasant, but it does happen. Now let's go to FOIL 23. This is a little bit busy, for which I apologize. I mentioned that TCP is very stateful. And here is one version, at least, of the Transmission Control Protocol state diagram. If you do a search on the Internet, you can find other versions of this, some of which may look a little bit nicer, so I encourage you to do that if you like. Every connection is going to start off at the top there in a closed state. It's not actually a real state. It just means there's no connection right now. The normal client path I've shown in red and the server path in blue. And what do I mean by server? The server is the side that listens for and accepts connections in the TCP world. So for MQ, this would be like the MQ listener program. And so let's follow that server side. If a program starts listening on the network, it has gone into a listen state, and it will sit there potentially for a long time. Now suppose that somebody is trying to connect, like an MQ channel starting up. It will send a SYN packet up to the server. Now the client, having done so, will go into a state called SYN underscore send. Now the server will receive that SYN packet, that's the first of our three-way handshakes, and it will reply with a SYNAC packet. The client side will receive that SYNAC packet, packet number two, and send packet number three, an acknowledgement, to the server. Now the server, once it receives that acknowledgement, it will move out of the SYN received state, and the connection can be go into an established state. And I should mention, all of this back and forth of packets is not actually handled directly by applications. MQ itself, for example, does not directly send SYN packets and SYNACs and the rest of it. This is handled by the operating system. Typically, it's something called the TCP/IP stack, which is just part of the operating system that works and acts as a liaison between programs like MQ and the actual network itself. So now, if you have a connection in an established state, this would be like a running channel. Data can flow back and forth, and that connection can stay established for a long, long time if you like. When it's time to shut down, one of the endpoints is going to choose to close the connection. And that's going to follow that red arrow. Whoever closes the connection will send the SYN packet to the other side, and it will then go into what's called a fin weight one state. On the right-hand side from the established state, you see a blue arrow. That's the side that receives the fin packet. It will send an acknowledgement and go into a close weight state. And when that side finally chooses to close itself, it will send a fin packet to move to what's called the last act state. And if we go over to the client who's still waiting in fin weight one, it will receive an ACK, it's gone to fin weight two. When it receives the fin packet from the other side, it will go to what's called a time wait state. I apologize, the states for closing are a little complicated just because either side can actually choose to close a connection. And in fact, both sides can choose to close a connection at the exact same time, which can be a little confusing. That's why there are six different states here. So it's a bit complicated. If you want to sit down and work it through, that's okay. But what I would suggest is just look at the bold arrows, which show the usual way that a connection is going to go down. Like an MQ sender channel that decides to close. It's typically the sender channel will go to a fin wait state, and then either to a fin wait 2 and then to a time wait state, or it'll go from fin wait 1 to time wait. The receiver channel in MQ is going to go to a close wait state, then a last act state, and then it's all done. So the closing side of things is regrettably a little bit complicated. Let's move on and talk about MQ itself now. This is foil number 24. MQ uses something called sockets for internet communication. MQ supports only TCP sockets, and it does support both IPv4 and IPv6. That's as of MQ version 6.0. Yes, there are other protocols MQ supports, like DECnet, SNA, LU6.2, NetBIOS, SPX, but those aren't internet protocols, and we won't talk about them here. The sockets interface is a programming interface. It's how programs interact with the TCP/IP stack and establish connections. It's almost universally used today. And these socket things that we'll be talking about are kind of like file descriptors. They're things that once created, you can write to them and read from them in a very natural sort of way. Every socket represents a communication endpoint. So any program that wants to use sockets, like a MQ channel or an MQ listener, has to always follow two steps. Step number one, create a socket. That's with the socket function. Step number two, assign an address to that socket, and that's the bind function. Every socket has to have an address, or it can't talk on the Internet. So let's take a look at how this happens in foil number 25. As before, is that foil 25, Elijah?
Mr. Robertson should be rejoining momentarily. Please stand by.
Okay, no worries. I'm going to see if I can't advance this myself. There we go. Foil number 25 is the MQ listener program. This is the program that really needs to be up first. For any communications to occur, you have to be listening first. Now, the MQ listener, and I've listed the program RunMQ LSR, which is its name on most programs. For those of you on ZOS, I believe it's the CHIN address space that does the listening for you. And for those of you on iSeries, there are both threaded and unthreaded listeners. I think it's the STRMQMLSRCL command for you. The MQ listener normally listens for any connections on port 1414, but as you probably know, you can listen on a different port. And you can even tell the listener to listen on a particular network card versus all cards if you have multiple network cards in a particular machine. So those are done through options to the RunMQ LSR program. They can control how does that listener bind its socket. Does it bind to 1414? Does it bind to 1415? What does it do? After creating and binding its socket, the listener will listen for connections. And when this listening state is in progress, the operating system will accept those three-way handshakes coming in from across the network. It will track those, and as a three-way handshake finishes, then it can now has an established session that it can give back to the listener program. So while those connections are being established, the operating system tracks them, and there's a value called the backlog that limits how many can be in the process of establishment at one time. And that parameter often causes a little confusion for people who think, well, geez, can my listener only support 100 connections coming in? No, 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 it can support thousands. It's just that maybe 100 at any one time in that three-way handshake stage might be a limit. When a handshake completes, the listener will accept the connection, and that actually creates a new socket representing the new connection. The original socket will continue listening. So now I'm going to move on to foil number 26. Oops, there we go. I think Elijah's back, so we're fighting over the foils. Foil 26, webs for MQ channels. An MQ channel, like a sender channel, is a TCP client application. It connects up to the server, which is the listener, which has to already be running. And it needs to know, where is the listener? What's the address and port for the listener? So any MQ channel that is connecting out will start by creating a socket and binding it to an address. But typically, we don't really care what this address is. MQ channels, by default, say, bind to any address. And MQ says port 0, which is a way of telling the operating system, your choice, I really don't care. And that lets the operating system choose a free, what's called an ephemeral port. Every system has a range of port numbers that it uses when it gets a request saying, bind me to anybody at all. To go back to the hotel room analogy, if you're in a hotel lobby and you pick up a phone and make a call to a hotel across town, room number 137, you don't necessarily know or care what is the phone number on that phone in the lobby. That's a bit what an ephemeral port is like. Once a sender channel or a sending type channel has bounded socket, it then calls connect. And the address it connects to is taken from that con name parameter in MQ. The connect function is what initiates that three-way handshake. And when it succeeds, the connection is now established, which takes us to the next foil, foil number 27. This is a view of an established connection. The box on either side is my attempt to draw for you a socket, what a socket looks like. And in between, we, of course, have the network. Now, a socket, it's an endpoint, yes, but every socket also has a bit of memory associated with it. There are, in fact, two buffers of memory associated with a socket, one for data going out over the socket, that's called the send buffer, and one for data being received off the network for that socket, and that's called the receive buffer. In this particular drawing, I've shown a large send buffer in one direction and a large receive buffer in that same direction in blue. This might be, for example, an MQ sender channel where all of the messages are going in one direction, so those buffers should be large. The buffers in the reverse direction may be pretty tiny because if you receiver channels don't actually send much data to sender channels, so they don't need much space. So in a socket, once it's been established, in order to use a socket, programs like MQ write to a socket if they want to send data. If they want to get data from a socket, they read from it. And sometimes a program may have to wait. For example, on the lower left, I've written the word poll with a little clock there. If a program wants to receive data from a socket and there's none there to receive, the poll function can wait and alert the program, at last, here's data for you to receive. On some operating systems, the function that does that is called select instead of poll, but they basically do the same job. So let's take a look at the write function on the upper left. A program that writes to a socket, what really happens is that data just goes into the socket send buffer. So the write function doesn't actually work with the network directly. It just gives it to the send buffer. And then it's up to the operating system to get that data across the network, which it does by sending TCP packets and waiting for acknowledgments and doing all of that stuff. So in some sense here, a socket is a way for a program like MQ to hand off to the operating system and say, please get this data there. Don't worry me too much about the details. And on we go, foil number 28. We're going to talk a little bit about some socket options. there are options that a program can use. I said that the operating system handles most of the work of shuffling this data around, but sometimes the program needs to modify how the operating system works a little bit. And there's a function called setSockOpt, which programs like MQ use to control the socket behavior. For example, and I'm actually going to go back one foil briefly here, if I may, Elijah, to number 27. How large should the send buffer be on a socket? And how large should the receive buffer be? MQ channels make a choice for themselves. A sender channel, knowing that it's going to send a lot of data, will make a big send buffer and a little receiver channel, or a little receive buffer. A receiver channel will do the exact opposite. Should data be sent with no delay at all? A thing that an operating system might choose to do is to say, I'm getting little dribs and drabs of data to this socket. A few bytes here, a few bytes here. I'm going to just let those build up in the send buffer so I can send a nice big packet, just one packet to the other side. Well, for some programs that's nice and efficient, and other programs want their data to flow right away. So there's an option that controls that. There's another option that says, well, if somebody closes a socket, what happens if they close and there's data still waiting to be sent? Well, the default behavior is the close will wait for a while and the operating system will drain that data and send it across, and after it's all gone, then the close function will finish. Another way of doing it is the close function works immediately and the connection gets reset. So there are two ways of terminating. And then there's another option which we're going to talk about in a moment called the TCP keep alive option. And that one causes a lot of angst, it seems, so we'll devote a few foils to that in a moment. Let's continue on to foil number 29. Transmission segment headers. These are an MQ construct. When an MQ channel starts up and establishes a connection in the way we've just seen, every bit of data that goes across an MQ channel has a data structure in front of it called a transmission segment header, or TSH. When you're working with MQ Level 2 support, for example, you may hear them say things like, well, I see the channel start up and it sends a TSH across and it gets a TSH coming back. That just means it's referring to flows going across and coming back the channel. TSHs, they do a lot for MQ. They can contain information that allow channels to negotiate startup. So you can still, in theory, connect a version 7 queue manager to a version 1 queue manager and it should work. I don't know if anybody's actually tried that, but it should, in theory, work through TSHs. Now, channels between queue managers, the TSHs flow at predictable intervals. We are going to be sending messages across regularly, and if we're not sending messages because there are none to be sent, MQ are going to send TSHs that contain heartbeats across at regular intervals. So the communications are pretty regular. MQ client applications, client channels are a little different. If a client application connects to MQ after the channel is established, the only time that there are going to be TSHs flowing back and forth are when the client does an API call. The API request will flow up in a TSH, MQ will do it and send back a response, and that's it. And the only exception is if a client application does an MQ get with wait. If you do a get and say, hey, I want to wait 10 minutes for a message, MQ will say, okay, well, during that get, I'm going to send heartbeats while the get is outstanding, just so you know that the connection is still there. So let's move on to foil number 30. So what do we do with idle connections? At a TCP level, if you have an established connection, once it's established, neither side is required to send any data on any particular schedule. A connection could, in theory, be established, sit idle, like Rip Van Winkle for however many decades he slept, and then finally start sending data. That's perfectly valid from a TCP point of view. And programs sometimes have a good reason for doing that. A way to simulate this, start up the AMQS PutC sample to your queue manager. AMQS PutC will will watch for you to type something and hit enter on the command line. And when you do hit enter, it will send your message across to the server. Well, what if you never hit enter, or you go to lunch and you come back? During that entire time, the TCP connection is totally idle. So how does the MQ server respond to this? There are no packets coming in at all. Well, some programs can test to see if the other side responds. They'll send something down and wait for a response to come back. That's kind of like what MQ heartbeats do. Sometimes that's not possible. Sometimes the other side will say, gee, I've received nothing. I'm going to close this connection. And the other alternative is just keep waiting forever and ever and ever. There's another question here, though, and this one's getting more important these days. What happens with networking hardware between your two endpoint systems, like a firewall or a router? How are they going to react when they see no packets? Well, historically, they didn't care too much. There were no packets, no problem. But these days, firewalls and routers often are required to keep track of connections for various reasons, security and so forth. They have to maintain a bit of memory about each connection. And therefore, they are not too inclined to want there to be connections that are sitting idle forever and ever. And in MQ support, we're seeing many, many firewalls and routers that say, right, you've got 1 hour. If there's no data in an hour, I'm resetting your connection for you. The other alternative is that they wait forever and ever and ever. So let's go on to FOIL 31, because we have a problem here. You could have an MQ client, and there are some other situations, like MQ JMS applications, where you might have a connection that's established and there's no activity for a long time. Well, how does this work? How does MQ really tell if the connection's still alive? And this is a socket option that MQ can enable called Keep Alive. On most systems, you enable Keep Alive by editing the qm.ini file to add two lines, tcp:keepalive=yes. This is done a bit differently on the mainframe. On Windows, I believe you can right-click on a queue manager in the Explorer, and there's a tab where you can choose whether or not the queue manager should do Keep Alive. So what the Keep Alive option does, when a program requests it, sets that option on the socket, it's up to the operating system. As that socket is established, the operating system will start up a timer for that connection. And every time packets arrive, that timer gets reset. But if there are no packets, that timer is going to start counting down and counting down and counting down. And when that timer expires, the operating system is going to start testing that connection to see if it's still alive or not. And if the connection doesn't respond, then the operating system is going to abort the connection. Let's go on to FOIL number 32. So this Keep Alive option is enabled on a per-connection basis. The fact that MQ may enable Keep Alive for its channels doesn't say anything about other network connections on your machine. And in fact, one queue manager can enable Keep Alive and another one might not have it enabled. I still encourage you to enable it for pretty much all your queue managers. So how long will the operating system let a connection sit idle? Well, the default is 2 hours, at least 2 hours. And it's that high of a time limit because there is an RFC that says it should be that high. The Keep Alive timeout, how long until the operating system tests a connection, is usually a global operating system value. You change it for a program like MQ, and you're actually changing it for every program on the machine, except on ZOS. MQ on ZOS, our channels have a parameter called Keep Alive Interval, or K-A-I-N-T. So you ZOS administrators are fortunate. You can actually tune this on a per-channel basis, which is very useful. So in many cases, you will want to set the Keep Alive limit for your operating system to a much lower value, on the order of maybe a few minutes. So what happens when that Keep Alive timer expires, when a connection has been idle for a while? The operating system will begin sending test packets, and those test packets don't contain any data. They also have the wrong sequence number in them, intentionally so. By sending the wrong sequence number, the operating system expects the other side to speak up and say, whoa, 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 that's not the right number, and to send an acknowledgement back with the correct number. And if it does get a response like that, then great, we received a packet, the Keep Alive timer expires. So Keep Alive does not immediately kill a connection just because it's been idle for a little while. A connection has to be idle, and it has to fail to respond to all of these Keep Alive tests. So on FOIL 33, my recommendations for Keep Alive. First, enable it for your queue managers. I strongly, strongly recommend you do that, particularly if your queue manager has MQ clients. And also, if your queue manager is hosting JMS applications, the reason for that, if you have a JMS application running in, say, WebSphere App Server, there's a thing there called connection pooling, where connections may be held in an idle state for JMS applications to reuse them. And when they're in that idle state, there's no data back and forth. So we don't want those connections getting killed. Reduce the keep alive timeout from 2 hours. A value of a few minutes, maybe 2 to 5 minutes, is pretty useful. And especially if you have firewalls or routers that kill idle connections, the most common limit there I've seen is 1 hour. You definitely want your keep alive timeout to be less than that. What will happen is if a connection goes idle for a while, say your keep alive limit is 10 minutes. Every 10 minutes, a keep alive test will flow down, and hopefully a response will come back. And your firewall will see that and say, oh, that connection's still active, and it will not kill it. So that's very important. And lastly, for AIX administrators, there are two APARs you should use. Make sure they're applied. I've listed them there. These are a little bit older, so I expect most people have them. What those APARs fix is an AIX problem where it would stop responding to keep alive probes after a certain amount of time. And so that could artificially cause your connections to get killed. So let's go on to slide 34, and which I have to give a mention here of a fellow named W. Richard Stevens. Rich Stevens wrote a number of truly excellent books on TCP/IP, on programming in Unix, on how these things work, and this presentation relies heavily on at least three of them. If I've done a poor job of explaining any of this, if you have lots of questions, you might want to look for one of these books because Stevens lays it out extraordinarily well. You'll find a better version than I have of that TCP state diagram and a lot more detailed information. So I listed three of Stevens' books. There are, in fact, more. You can also visit Rich Stevens' website, which is www.kohala.com/start. Now, unfortunately, Rich Stevens himself actually passed away in 1999, but his website is still maintained. There's a lot of useful information out there, including a really excellent recipe for chocolate chip cookies. So I've tried them, and they're great. So if that's your kind of thing, you might want to give it a try, too. 435, please. So what have we talked about? Well, we've talked about the Internet Protocol, IP, unreliable packet routing between machines. We talked about TCP, which enhances IP with these sequence numbers and acknowledgments. It makes it possible to have reliable data transfer between programs running on machines. And MQ uses these using the sockets programming interface to send and receive messages over channels, and in the case of clients, to send and receive API calls to a remote queue manager. And lastly, we talked about TCP/IP keep alive, which is testing whether or not an idle connection is still there or whether something has happened that the other side is gone. Now, next time, in part two, we're going to be putting a lot of this theory to practice. I appreciate that we haven't talked very much yet about MQ and different attributes on channels. The next presentation will get more into that sort of thing. So if this was all theory this time, I hope it will be useful in the next session. On to foil number 36, please. Here are some additional WebSphere product resources that you can refer to. I'm not going to go through all of these. You can look at them at your leisure, but I do encourage you to do so. And at this point, I think I've said everything I need to do. I apologize if it's been a bit long, but it's a lot of material and some of it in a reasonable amount of depth. So at this point, I'm going to turn it back to Elijah.
Thank you, Justin, for a great presentation.
We have a question from Sonette Gomez, PHHRVOS.
I'd like to know more about the two-hour limit. Is it only for AIX or Linux as well?
The two-hour limit is actually the default on all operating systems, as far as I know. That would include Windows, iSeries, HP, Solaris. That's the default value, but you can drop it on each operating system. How exactly you do so depends on the OS. Like on Windows, it's a registry value. On Linux, it's something you can modify through the proc file system, for example. But on both of them, it is actually a two-hour limit, unless you've reconfigured it.
I see. Is it in seconds or 120 minutes? Because we had loads of issues with Kaint and Keep Alive, and which caused our queue managers to not start up or not come down because the client was actually doing nothing.
Right.
We still had
The actual units used on each operating system varies.
Okay.
On AIX, for example, I believe it's 14,400 half seconds.
Oh, I see.
And on some it's in seconds, on others it's in milliseconds. So the only way to tell is to go to the operating system documentation. What I can do, I haven't yet posted to the web the foils for part two.
Okay.
I'll make a note and I'll see if I can include some specific links on that.
Okay, sure. That would be helpful. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We have no further questions. Let me offer one final opportunity for our phone callers to signal for a question. That is star one. Again, if you have a question. Shyam God with Wachovia.
As you stated, when the keep alive option is enabled, and it will send a wrong sequence number packet back to the client, and it will expect a correct sequence number packet. Is it expecting from the application, or is it expecting from the operating system or server or system itself?
That's a very good question. The response that comes back should actually be generated by the operating system. The keep alive test probes are done by the operating system. They're not done, for example, directly by MQ. And the responses that come back come from the TCP/IP stack on the client machine. It will respond affirmatively if the client application is still there. If the machine, for example, say the machine was rebooted, and is back again, and it gets a keep-alive probe, it will send a reset packet in that case. But it's actually the operating system that handles the requests and the responses both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we have no further questions at this time. Mr. Robertson, I'd like to turn the conference back over to you for additional or closing remarks.
Thank you, Dahlia. At this time, we conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation. We hope you will join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on the site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining today, and thank you, Justin, for presenting today.
Thank you.